This is David Getoff, and I have been asked to, would I please put an MP3 or an article, and the recording is a lot faster for me, on sugars and sweeteners up on my website. So that's what this is. I've done a number of lectures on different radio stations in this regard, but I've never bothered to put one up on my own website. So what do we know about sugars, sweeteners, sugar converters such as starches and alcohol? What is it helpful for you to know? And what are the best sweeteners? What are the worst sweeteners? This may end up getting longer than I intended for it to be, but such is life. So first of all, everybody needs sugar, but you don't need it in your mouth. You need it in your bloodstream. And that's very, very, very different. If you don't have adequate sugar of a specific type called glucose, which is the only sugar they look at when they do a blood test called blood sugar. It really shouldn't be called a blood sugar test by anybody. That is a misrepresentation. It should always be given its correct name of blood glucose level. If your blood glucose level gets too low, you pass out. Your brain can't function. You have no energy. So we need to have an amount of sugar in the blood. However, the body can manufacture sugar from all sorts of different things and get it into the bloodstream. The body's preferential source of energy, according to nutritional biochemistry and also just historical use of foods, has always been fats and fatty acids. And it's only more recently since a rather harmful thing, although it's not totally harmful, but in many ways it has been harmful, called agriculture, developed, where we are destroying the planet by growing all sorts of things when everything used to only grow wild, and where we had lots of animals which would refertilize the planet when they would their stool would go on it. Now we've got agriculture everywhere, and agriculture is defacing our planet. So we must have, I get sidetracked here. That's me. Anybody that knows me knows I'm often more wordy than I sometimes need to be, but it does give more information. So we must have blood sugar. If you take a look at a laboratory test, that would be a laboratory blood test, and you look at one in which it includes somebody's blood sugar being looked at, you will see various different reference ranges. It just depends on the particular lab. But overall, usually, it says the reference range. Now note, that's not the healthy range, that's not the optimal range, that's the reference range. That's the words they use. Reference range, usually for most lab tests I've looked at, and this is toward the middle of 2012, reference range for blood glucose, which is also called blood sugar, is generally 65 to 99. That's what I usually see the most often. It depends on the laboratory. Some of them, they say 70 to 99. I've seen a bunch of different ones. But very often I see 65 to 99. Some people, 65 is too low. And if they have a blood sugar of 65, they already start to feel faint. But that's what I see most often. So we need blood sugar. If your blood sugar was 10, you'd be dead. If your blood sugar was, 45 or 50, and I don't know these numbers exactly because this is not my specialty, but I believe you'd be in a diabetic coma. In any event, 65 to 99 is normal. Normal, however, is not healthy. The people who will live the longest, according to a number of longevity experts, are the people whose bodies are able, and that ability comes from a combination of what your pancreas and your liver are able to do, as well as what kinds of foods you're putting in your mouth, those people whose bodies are able to hold their blood sugar probably between about 75 and 85 all day long. Once you start getting up over 85, some of the experts that I've heard at some of my nutritional medicine conferences would already call you pre-diabetic. So if somebody says, oh yeah, every time I get a blood sugar done on a lab test, I come up at 90 or 92 or 93 or 94, these particular experts would say that's pre-diabetic. A doctor can't use those terms because the doctor's hands are tied. They must use the terms in the way they are written in to their medical criteria. And therefore, they can't tell you if your blood sugar is 92 or 93 or even 98 that you're pre-diabetic, even though you actually are, because that designation doesn't begin to come until you get up over 100. But nonetheless, things don't happen with 1 point difference. They're happening as you're getting up there. So what are the things which we eat and what are the things in our bodies, namely the different organ systems, which again I mentioned are pancreas and liver, that have to do with helping to adjust your blood sugar? And again, that's blood glucose. I will use those terms interchangeably. So number one, if your liver is not working as well as it should, and none of the liver function tests are accurately able to give you that information, so the liver function test that the doctor orders, he can say or she can say your liver function is perfect, and they don't actually know that because there isn't any test that can prove that. All it can show is that it hasn't gotten so bad that the liver numbers elevate out of range. It could be 60% below optimal. Some of the experts say 70 or 75% below optimal, and all the liver function tests still show us working within range. So you can't really look at that and know. But nonetheless, if the liver is not working as well as it should, even though the tests will not show that, if the pancreas is not working as well as it should, producing insulin, then somebody eating the kinds of foods that another person whose organs are working well would not be bothered by, yet this person eating the same amount of starches and sugars is bothered by, bothered meaning that it's made them diabetic, because their organs are working too poorly to be able to regulate the blood sugar. So number one is always foods and the organs. And they're both equal for number one. I mean, that's really what it is. So I'm not going to go over all the ways to support your liver and your pancreas. That would be a 2 or 3 hour lecture. But we will go over the place that your mouth has in all these problems. So first of all, what are the categories of foods that cause blood sugar abnormalities? In other words, the things that make your blood sugar higher than it should be. And those foods are most, but not all, sugars. All starches, although some convert to sugar more rapidly. And all alcohols. So basically, sugars, starches, and alcohols affect your blood sugar. So let's start with alcohols, because that's a real simple one. Anything that's an alcohol, whether it's a beer, whether it's a wine, whether it's a distilled spirit, your body certainly doesn't treat it exactly like it would a sugar, because if you eat sugar, it doesn't make you intoxicated. However, as far as converting it, it converts it into sugar. So in one respect, your body considers alcohol to be a candy bar. Not in all respects, because you're not going to get high from a candy bar. But as far as the sugar is concerned, your body says, oh, well, we're just going to turn that into sugar, otherwise known as blood sugar, which is blood glucose, and you ate a candy bar. So every time you have any kind of alcohol, your body turns it into blood sugar, and depending on how well your pancreas and your liver are operating, it may be able to regulate it where it needs to be, or it may go way out of range. Certainly, if you have diabetes, it will cause a major escalation. If you have cancer, it will end up feeding your cancer. So alcohol is the easy one, because alcohol is alcohol. It doesn't really matter which alcohol, you know, certainly be different amounts and different amounts of alcohol, but alcohol is alcohol. Your body treats it like a candy bar. So next category is, which one do we want to do next? Let's do starches next. So the next category is starches. Starches, there are lots of. And they can be similar, but some of them are very different. So let's give a quick example of that. What would two relatively different types of starches be? Both beans, also called legumes, and grains, are somewhere around 70-75% starch. However, for some reason, the beans convert into sugar much more slowly than the grains do. And therefore, if somebody had some sized portion of beans, let's say you've got some kidney beans, pinto beans, Anastasi beans, mung beans, cannellini beans, rice beans, there are a lot of different beans out there. Most people have never heard of most of them. Lentils, green lentils, red lentils, brown lentils. In any event, all of those are beans. And your body, if you ate an equal amount, whether that portion, that equal amount, whether it's by volume or by weight, you know, somebody says 4 ounces, and I have to say 4 ounces by volume or 4 ounces by weight. Because a 4 ounce volume, for example, of lead weighs way more than 4 ounces, because volume and weight are different. But if you had an equal volume or an equal weight of beans and grains, the beans will much more slowly, over a longer period of time, turn into sugar in your body, and therefore they cause less damage. And that would make beans, unless you happen to be allergic to a bean, that would make the beans a much healthier starch choice if you're going to have a starch with a meal, as long as you steer clear of soybeans because of all their problems that I'm not going to cover, because that would be another hour. Now, there is one grain which converts into sugar as slowly as the beans do. And that one grain is the grain barley. So if you're not allergic or don't have any problems, then if you like grains, you want to have a bowl of hot cereal in the morning. Probably one of the healthiest hot cereals would be a bowl of whole kernel, heirloom quality organic barley, cooked as long as you want to cook it so that you like its texture, because of how much more slowly it will turn into sugar than any other grain you might choose. So either of those, grains or beans, 70-75%, maybe a little bit more starch, but the beans or barley will turn much more slowly into sugar. And if you happen to be gluten intolerant, most likely you're not really. That's another lecture. You're probably wheat intolerant. And a lot of people who think they're gluten intolerant but are actually wheat intolerant can find out if they are symptomatic. In other words, if every time they eat gluten, they get a reaction. By trying some heirloom quality organic barley, and when they don't react to it, since there's plenty of gluten in barley, they just found out that it's not really gluten, it's wheat that's their problem. So now we've got the starches. Now, what are other starches? Well, those are the main starches, because most people get their starch from pasta and crackers and cakes and cookies and chips. All of those are starches. And when you process the starch, in other words, instead of a bowl of brown rice, red rice, black rice, millet, amaranth, quinoa, instead of a bowl of one of those, if you have something that was made out of a flour made from one of those, where you've ground the grain into a flour first, you have made the particle size smaller, of course. It's now an itty-bitty, teeny-weeny pieces of a flour. And the body can act on it more closely. Your digestive juices, your digestive enzymes, chyme in your saliva, the hydrochloric acid in your stomach, the digestive enzymes in your intestines. And therefore, you will break it down much faster than if it was the actual whole grain. So you have sped up the speed with which it will turn into and spike your blood sugar level. So that makes it even worse. As far as the other starches are vegetable starches. So we have vegetables that are predominantly starch. Just like the grains and beans are 70-75% starch, we have vegetables that are either that much and even more starch. And that includes all potatoes. They're all mostly starch. And I mean all potatoes. So don't say, well, how about sweet potatoes? How about, I said, all potatoes. There are slight differences in the conversion speed. These sweet potatoes would convert more slowly, but they are all mostly starch. That includes yams. It includes winter squash. Not summer squash. Summer squash are things like crookneck and zucchini. Winter squash are things like kabocha, pumpkins, Tahitian. I mean, there are a bunch of winter squashes. When somebody says, how will I know something is a winter squash or a summer squash? I came up with a cute, easy way for you to tell. If you hit it with your fist and you squish it, in other words, if you hurt the squash, it is a summer squash and it is not a starch-based squash. If you were to hit the squash with your fist and the squash hurt you, then it's full of starch and it will hurt you. It's a real easy way. And anybody that knows the difference between the two types of squashes would immediately go, well, that's right. If you hit a summer squash, you'll squash it. If you hit a winter squash, nothing will happen except you'll hurt your hand. So we've got all of those. Then there are a couple of others which are not into that category. So corn, for example, is almost pure starch, not to mention all the genetically modified problems with it. So corn you need to avoid if you want to keep your blood sugar down where it should be, if you want to not feed your cancer cells, if you know you have them or even if you don't have them, if you have diabetes. So we want to keep starch down. And we want to keep all the different starches, whether they're vegetable-based, grain-based, bean-based, or legume-based is better, definitely. But, still watch it. And, of course, alcohol. Which brings us to sugar, which probably a lot of you are saying, that's all I wanted to know. Well, that's too bad, because the other things are just as important. You really need to know all of them. I have people that avoid sugar and are eating all the other things that are wrong and are going to end up as non-sugar consumers who are diabetic. Because many, many people do not have a sweet tooth. That's not their issue. And they've developed diabetes because they love bread or because they love pasta or because they love cakes or cookies, which are even worse because bread and pasta aren't loaded with sugar also. They're just the grains. So you really need to know all of it. That's why I'm trying to be all-inclusive, even if it's more than you want. So now we've got all the different types of sugars, and let's not use the word sugars at the beginning. Let's say all the different types of sweeteners, because I don't feel like doing a separate recording on sweeteners where I talk about artificial ones. We're going to put them all together in here. So let's do the artificial ones first. That way we can get them the hell out of the way. There is no legitimate reason, unless you are trying to make yourself unhealthy, or unless, like most of the public and the medical profession, you're simply ignorant. That's another reason people do things they shouldn't do. There is no legitimate reason to consume an artificial sweetener. Artificial sweeteners, Jonathan Wright puts it very, very well. He calls them alien molecules because they never existed anywhere on the planet Earth until they were manufactured or combined in a way that the Earth can't combine them in a laboratory. So whether we're talking about saccharin, sucralose, acesulfame K, aspartame, cyclamates, neotame, I mean, I don't care if it's one that's currently in use in this country or other countries or it hasn't been developed yet. We don't need to bring in an alien molecule and find out 5 years later or 25 years later that because the body was never designed to be able to properly metabolize it, utilize it, and excrete it, that it causes all sorts of things. We know aspartame greatly increased the seizure level, greatly increased the number of brain cancers, and if anybody says that's nonsense, David doesn't know what he's talking about, he's making it up, I implore you, unless you like to stay ignorant and keep your head in the sand, which a lot of people do like to do, they don't like to know the truth, buy a copy of the movie Sweet Misery, A Poisoned World, and watch Sweet Misery. It is a legitimate scientific documentary on how in the heck a poisonous substance that causes cancer and other issues called aspartame, could also called NutraSweet and Equal and other different things, could possibly have gotten made legal in the United States. Watch that movie and you will know the answer. And after you've watched it, you'll go, oh my, and you'll start lending it out to everybody you know. I highly recommend it. If, on the other hand, you want to know about the dangers of sugar, then you can pick up a copy of Sweet Suicide by Nancy Appleton, and that will go over the dangers of sugar. Those are the two movies I like best in that regard. So there isn't any reason for any of the artificial sweeteners. And for those of you who are saying, sure, there's a reason, I'm trying to lose weight, that bogus piece of garbage was dispelled in two large studies that I believe were both funded by the American Dietetics Association that gets a lot of their funding from the artificial sweetener and the sugar industry. And the studies were done, the first one was done quite a number of years ago. They wanted to prove that those people that switched over and sweetened all of their foods with non-nutritive artificial sweeteners such as aspartame, saccharin, etc., would lose weight as compared to the group that was using sugar in the same foods. And they found that there was no change whatsoever. Couldn't figure it out. I just automatically assumed that that maybe the artificial sweeteners slowed down your metabolism or did something else bad, but they couldn't figure it out. They figured maybe there's something wrong with the research study. So many years later, more recently, a second study, either equally large or larger, was done to once again prove that if people would simply switch over equal amounts of sweetening agents from sugars to the artificial sweeteners that don't have any calories, that there would be a bunch of weight loss. And once again, they found no weight loss, didn't do any of that. Of course, they didn't realize they were probably raising neurological diseases and cancer rates, but no weight loss. And so we now know from two beautiful, well-done studies, the opposite of what the people hoped it was going to show, that it doesn't do any of that. Well, I may have some diabetics that say, yes, but it won't raise my blood sugar. Actually, that's true. It won't raise your blood sugar. However, in many cases, it will raise your insulin levels because the body tastes the sweet and thinks that it's getting sugar. And in any event, it's harmful. So stop eating it. If you want something sweet, use a sweetener that doesn't cause any of those problems, which we'll be going over over the next however long it takes me to get through this. So if you care about your health, which most of you don't, but if you're listening to this tape, you probably do, then stop anything with artificial sweeteners in it. If it says Splenda, if it says sucralose, if it says aspartame, if it says saccharin, I mean, anything in there, if it's an artificial sweetener, if you care about your health, stop consuming it. Don't use less. Don't get bitten by the king cobra or the rattlesnake less often. Don't use it. So now we switch over to another classification of sweeteners. And we'll do the sugar alcohols next. The sugar alcohols are the sugars, which instead of ending with A-S-E, because the true sugars end with A-S-E, excuse me, O-S-E, I'm not thinking correctly, O-S-E. So that would be sucrose, maltose, lactose, you know, those are the true sugars. The sugar alcohols don't end that way, they end in O-L. And so we have maltitol, sorbitol, xylitol, erythritol. Those are the sugar alcohols. And no, they're not going to get you high. And no, they don't contain alcohol in the way you think of as alcohol. It has to do with the biochemistry and the actual formulas, which a chemist would look at the formula and say, oh, that's sugar alcohol. Now, the sugar alcohols don't convert into blood sugar. So if you have some sorbitol, xylitol, erythritol, you don't get a spike of blood sugar like you would with most of the natural sugars. However, the body doesn't like sugar alcohols especially. And some of them, two main ones, sorbitol and maltitol, which have been used in dietetic and diabetic candies and chocolates for a long, long time, cause a GI or gastrointestinal reaction. And a large number of people, after eating not very much or not very many of the diabetic or dietetic hard candies or chocolates, end up with anything from moderate loose stool to massive diarrhea to even explosive diarrhea. The newer sugar alcohols, the ones that are being used more these days, which are xylitol, and that's spelled with an X, and erythritol, have much less of what we call a gastrointestinal or GI response. So if you're eating something that's made with a sugar alcohol, to be able to stay away from the glycemic or sugar conversion of response. Glycemic has to do with how fast the body turns something into sugar. If you're using the sugar alcohols for that, you're usually better off finding things that are sweetened with xylitol, again, that begins with an X, or erythritol, because they have less GI responses. Now, I have met people that can't use one or the other or both of those either, or they instantly get massive diarrhea. So if it causes you that problem, stay away from it. But a lot of people can use moderate amounts of xylitol, and an even greater amount of people can use moderate amounts of erythritol. The problem is that very often they're made from genetically modified corn, and apparently there's some kind of residue, and people sometimes react to that. Because I've had people that react to xylitol, and when I give them U.S. non-GMO xylitol sent out or shipped out by a company called Xylitol USA, all of a sudden they can eat it. So sometimes it's not the xylitol causing the problem, it's something else in the way it was made. But xylitol and erythritol are acceptable if they don't cause you a problem. I don't want people to eat a lot of them. It's not something that was, you know, naturally used, by the human body. But they're certainly far better than many of the others. Which brings us to the regular sugars. As I said, that would include many, just a few of which would be lactose, milk sugar, maltose, glucose, which is what we call blood sugar, sucrose, which is a white table sugar, what you have in your container in your house, as well as some of the ones that are less refined. The only one that is really fairly unrefined is called Rapadora, R-A-P-A-D-O-R-A. That's made in Germany, in which they simply take organic sugar cane, squeeze out the juice, let it dry in the sun, and they grind it up into the crystal size they want and put it in a box or a bag. That's Rapadora. All of the other natural sugar powders are not as unrefined as they claim to be. So you have sugar in the raw, you have turbinado sugar, you've got sucanat, which is supposed to stand for sugar natural. None of those are as unrefined as the Rapadora, where they just squeeze it out and let it dry in the sun. However, all of them, including Rapadora, are still predominantly sugar. And therefore, they feed cancer cells, they depress the immune system for many hours after you've consumed it, which will also happen if you have a piece of bread, because your body will turn the bread into a number of teaspoons of sugar and depress your immunity. So we're much better off if we can eat as little sugar as possible and have the blood sugar held level by conversion from things like fats and by eating adequate amounts of proteins, etc., and not from the sugars themselves. So which of those sugars are better and which of the sugars are worse? Well, the biggest issue seems to be fructose or fructose. I've always pronounced it fructose. I know some people use fructose. In any event, that's the standard designation for fruit sugar. It's a little bit of a misnomer because there are many different sugars in different fruit, and fructose is not the only sugar in fruit. But it is the dominant sugar, and it is called fruit sugar or fructose or fructose. I'm going to call it fructose because that's what I'm used to calling it. The problem is that a lot of people are deciding which sugar and how much to use if they're using real sugars based on something called the glycemic index. The glycemic index, as I mentioned a little while ago, has to do with the rapidity or speed with which the body converts a food into blood sugar or glucose. So if you have something, for example, like a baked potato, the body will turn that starch very rapidly into blood sugar, and therefore it has a very high glycemic index. If you want to learn about different foods and glycemic indices, go to Mendoza. I believe that's M-E-N-D-O-S-A, Mendoza.com, or just put in Mendoza space glycemic, G-L-Y-C-E-M-I-C, into Google. It'll bring you up onto Mendoza's website. You can go into his list and see hundreds, if not thousands, of different foods and their glycemic indices. And you can take a look at all the differences. But there are other issues. So again, like I said, with beans and grains, you can have the same amount of starch. In other words, the same amount of sugar will be produced if you have 100 grams of a starch from a grain, such as oats or oatmeal or quinoa or amaranth or barley or whatever, as you will if you get 100 grams from a bean. But if the 100 grams of starch comes from eating a bunch of beans versus eating any grain other than barley, because barley is the slower converter, you will produce the same amount of sugar because it's the same amount of starch. But it will be produced over a longer period of time. Your body will be utilizing it during that time, or maybe storing some of it as fat and making you heavy. And therefore, the blood sugar doesn't go up as much in the slow converters, like the beans, as it does in the fast converters like most of the grains. It will make as much sugar, but over a longer period of time, and therefore it doesn't spike it in the same way. So, now we're talking about regular sugars, and I'm saying that we have a problem, and the problem is fructose. And the reason is because pretty much all the other sugars, the body converts into blood sugar. That's part of the digestion conversion process. It converts it into blood sugar. Fructose is different. Fructose does not get rapidly turned into blood sugar. Fructose remains predominantly as fructose. So you'd have to do a blood fructose test, which is available in some labs. You'd have to do a blood fructose test to see how much fructose there was in your body. You can't do a blood sugar test. It doesn't look at fructose. Well, why is that a problem? It's a problem because fructose is very damaging. We have now found, and I don't mean we, I don't include myself in that, because I am not a research scientist. So don't shoot the messenger if you don't like what I'm telling you. We've now found that fructose seems to be possibly the most damaging of all the sugars. And the reason is because of the way it's handled in our liver. Or in our livers, because we are lots of people, and so we each have our own liver. What happens is that fructose causes a lot more damage to the liver than the other sugars do in the way it is turned into triglycerides and fats in and by the liver. In other words, if somebody consumed an equal amount of any number of sugars, the person consuming the amount as fructose is going to do more damage to their liver and be causing fatty liver disease and all sorts of other major problems, including maybe needing a liver transplant, than they would with an equal amount of other sugars. But it's worse than that. It's worse than that because since it's doing that without converting to blood sugar, the patient and the doctor don't know it's going on until it's happened. Because if they keep on monitoring somebody's blood sugar, or even better, their glycosylated hemoglobin, also called hemoglobin A1C and listed on a blood test as HA, the number 1 and the letter C, that gives you sugar handling ability over 60 to 90 days. the doctor might be monitoring that and your blood sugar level, and they might always look fine because all of the sugars you're consuming are fructose-based, and not realize all the destruction that is being going on is occurring to your liver, even though the blood sugar looks fine, because fructose does its damage without converting to blood sugar. So we have a big problem, because people that understand glycemic and that have learned to try and eat foods that are lower on the glycemic index, and the ones you really want to eat if you want to be healthy are the ones that have, this is now my opinion, glycemic indices of around 50 and below. So if you take a look at the glycemic chart and you see that rice milk has a glycemic index, depending on the chart you look at, is between 80 and 90 because of how fast it turns to sugar, whereas whole milk, whole cow's milk, has a glycemic index of about 40 because all the fats that are in it slow down the sugar conversion and make it much healthier for you. I drink personally between 6 and 8 quarts of raw, unpasteurized, unhomogenized, grass-fed, whole raw milk a week. So again, because the fructose doesn't convert to glucose, it has a low glycemic index, and people get misled. You look at misled, and you could look at it, and you could say they're getting missled. Very similar, and they are. They're getting missled. They're getting a missile shot at them. They're getting misled. So people go, well, I can eat this food because it has a low glycemic index, and therefore it's okay. And that would include anything that doesn't have a lot of starch in it and that's sweetened with a low glycemic sugar, namely fructose. Well, the problem is that fructose causes fatty liver disease, even though it doesn't cause a blood sugar spike. So let's take a look. Where are the ways, what are the places that fructose is? And it's not really hiding there. I mean, everybody that knows these substances should know that it's there, but many don't. And so number one, we're going to just say fructose itself. Well, where do we find fructose? Obviously, we find it in fruit. Well, but wait a minute, people have been eating fruit for hundreds of thousands of years. That's true, but we didn't have refrigerators, we didn't have freezers, heck, we didn't have electricity. Okay, we didn't have canning, we didn't have packaging, we didn't have freeze drying. So basically, if you were eating fruit, unless you happen to be one of the very small part of the population that lived in a very hot tropical climate, you know, like Hawaii or the tropics, if you weren't in one of those places, fruit was only available for a small portion of the year during the hottest parts of the summer. That's the fruit season. So you would have fruit available, depending on the particular fruit, because fruit ripen at different times. You would have fruit depends on where you are in the country, of course, and how long of a hot season they have. Some places you've got fruit available if it's only locally grown for 4 weeks, some places 6 weeks, some 8 weeks, some 10 weeks, probably some 12 weeks. That's probably about it. And then it's gone. Now, again, I'm talking about traditionally speaking, you know, thousands of years ago. Today, we have hothouses where we can grow things when the weather wouldn't otherwise allow it. We have both genetic engineering and hybridization, where we can crossbreed strains of fruit from plants that grow in different parts of the world where they never would have cross-pollinated because they wouldn't be anywhere near each other. So we can do all sorts of things to both genetically modify and hybridize species so that we can get early season varieties, late season varieties, much higher sugar content varieties, and that's what we've done. And again, I'm not part of this. I don't do these things. I say we, I mean we as a population. So we have made all sorts of species of fruit, and we've done it with vegetables too, all species of fruit which have way more sugar content than the original one ever had. We've developed fruit that never existed on the planet Earth. You know, you take an apricot and a plum, you cross them in a way that never happened normally, and all of a sudden you have a pluot or a plumcot. You have all sorts of things that didn't exist, and we're trying to make things that the public likes, and we have all developed a horrendous sweet tooth. As a matter of fact, a mouth full of sweet teeth. So we now have much higher sugar content in the fruit. We have fruit that can go for much longer in the season Plus, we could ship it in from other places, and then we compound the issue by having a government and doctors who, because of their ignorance, don't know any better, that tell their patients, eat more fruit, it's good for you. And for most people, they should eat more non-starchy vegetables of various colors to get all the nutrients that are in the fruit without all of the high sugar content. So we never ate the amount of sugar that we do now. Okay, so that's the fruit in general. And the little berries seem to have the highest nutrients and the lowest sugar content. So when somebody says, what fruit do I eat wild blueberries, and I eat blackberries, raspberries, elderberries. I stay away from strawberries. I can't find any that haven't been hybridized, have way, way too much sugar in them. My favorite fruit are wild blueberries. You can get wild blueberries at some Trader Joe's in the frozen section. You can get wild organic blueberries from vitalchoice.com. A wild blueberry is anywhere between about a tenth and a fifth the size of the hybridized blueberries that we're all used to. And when you cut into a wild blueberry, it's the same color inside as it is outside, because that color has lots of nutrients in it. When you cut into a really high-quality organic but not wild, so it's therefore hybridized blueberry, the outside is the same color as the wild ones. The inside varies in shades of white or cream color or light green and has about a third the nutrients of the wild. The research done, I forget if it was in Italy or France, showed the wild blueberries of an equal portion size of number of grams has between 300% and 400% more antioxidant nutrients than the ones that we're normally buying in the store. So, we've got that. Now, we're back to fructose again. Not that we've really ever left it. So the problem is, other than fruit, which I've now just told you we should eat less of than we do, and if you're eating it, it should be the little berries, now we have the places that fructose is concentrated, with the main one being, of course, high fructose corn syrup, because since fructose is sweeter than regular sugars, I shouldn't say that because fructose is a regular sugar, but if you increase the fructose really, really high, above the level it would be in a fruit, for example, there isn't any fruit on the planet Earth that is 50% pure fructose. It doesn't exist. But high fructose corn syrup is approximately 50% pure fructose because it has been concentrated in the laboratory, in industry, to be very high fructose, so it can be used not as a fruit for people to bite into, but as a sweetening agent. So high fructose corn syrup, from what I've read and seen on the sites that go over this, is between about 50 and 52% pure fructose. And therefore, when you have something sweetened with high fructose corn syrup, it's not going to spike your blood sugar level because, as I said before, fructose does its damage as fructose. It doesn't all rush into glucose and throw your glycemic index up. It stays mostly fructose, and so it's not high glycemic. Anything that gets its sweetness from fructose is not high glycemic. It's very dangerous. It's very damaging when we eat too much of it, you know, more than maybe a piece of fruit a day, but it doesn't do it by converting. So high fructose corn syrup in any substance, whether you're sweetening a confection with it, whether you're sweetening a drink with it, if it's sweetened with high fructose corn syrup or just corn syrup, which is still very high fructose but not quite as high, if it's sweetened with corn syrup, like Karo syrup, for example, which is corn syrup, then it's not going to spike your blood sugar. It's not high glycemic. It does all of its horrible damage as fructose without converting. So then the question is there anything out there that we have to watch out for besides not eating too much corn syrup? None would be good. Eating very little high fructose corn syrup? None would be good. Watching our fruit intake, eating only fresh raw fruit and not too much of it? Is there anything else that's very high in fructose? And it turns out there are a couple things, with the main one being the new darling of the health food sweetening industry. And that is agave nectar. Agave is a cactus. I'm not sure if technically it's classified as a cactus or a succulent. They're a little bit different. I used to run a plant store. But in either event, whether it's a succulent or a cactus, agave, just like maple sugar trees, and for that matter, even all maple trees, and many other trees, has a little bit of sugar in its sap. So if somebody has a maple tree in their yard and they tap it to make maple syrup, the sap that comes out is a little bit sweet. And the sap from the agave cactus, I'll call it a cactus, is a little bit sweet. And with the agave, the sweetness comes from fructose. Well, what they do is they want to turn it into a sweetener. Just like when you get maple syrup in the store, that maple syrup didn't come out of a maple tree. It did originally come out of a maple from a sugar maple, but they then had to boil it and boil it and boil it and boil it to get all the extra water to come off and the sugar stayed there until they could get it sweet enough and get its Brix level, its B-R-I-X, which is a sweetness level, high enough that they could call it maple syrup. Well, the same thing with agave nectar. They have to process it to concentrate the fructose, because agave, the nectar that comes out of the agave plant, which is not a nectar, it's a pulp, is sweet. It's sort of sweet. You can tell it's sweet. But they've got to bring it into industry and concentrate it to death, so to speak, to make it sweet enough to get the other stuff out to concentrate the fructose. So now we have super concentrated fructose. And guess what? The amount of fructose in agave nectar, the way you would buy it in a store, is even higher than the amount of fructose in high fructose corn syrup. High fructose corn syrup is listed as 50 to 52% fructose. Agave nectar of the standard agave nectar is purchased in the store after they've concentrated it and made it into a product that is packaged is 52 to 56% fructose. So basically, they're equal. Agave nectar is just as dangerous as high fructose corn syrup. They both are going to end up possibly causing fatty liver disease. But worse yet, something I haven't even mentioned yet, is that fructose does a lot of its damage by causing what's called insulin resistance. We have different types of diabetes. We've got a form of diabetes that is caused by the body not being able to manufacture enough insulin. And then we've got the kind of diabetes that's caused by the body's making plenty of insulin, but our cells have become resistant to the insulin, and even though we're making enough, it's not doing its job. And so we have huge numbers of our population that are developing type 2 diabetes, which is called adult onset diabetes because you're not born with it. And we're getting this from eating too much starch, too much alcohol, too much sugar, and we now know from the research studies that fructose is a major cause of type 2 or adult onset diabetes. And so high fructose corn syrup is a good way to help make it way more likely that you're going to get diabetes, which huge numbers of people are. But if you want to make it even more likely that you're going to get diabetes, then switch over from high fructose corn syrup to agave nectar, which is slightly higher in fructose. So they're very damaging, and people don't know this. Now, I've read a couple of articles written by some scientists that have looked into agave nectar and have found that the manufacturers that are making confections, they're making cookies and cakes and fudge and candies, they want things to be as sweet as possible so they don't have to add too much of it. It's much easier if you're adding something as a sweetening agent to get the highest sweetening agent possible so you don't have to put as much in. So apparently, if what I've been told is correct, even though when you buy agave nectar in the store in a container, it's 52 to 54% or 52 to 56% pure fructose and is already very, very damaging, the industry buys a further concentrated one that you can't get in the store, and they're buying apparently 75 to 90% pure fructose agave nectar. And so when you buy something that is already made, in other words, you're not buying the agave nectar in the store. You're buying a confection. You're buying a cookie or a cake, and it says sweetened with agave nectar. That was even higher in fructose. But, of course, that part doesn't matter because they simply use less of it to get to the same sweetness level. The point is fructose is not a healthy sugar in the quantities that we're consuming. And when people say everything in moderation is okay, I will agree with that if the word moderation is not used in such a distorted, contorted way that Merriam-Webster you know, one of our dictionary people, or Noah Webster, another one of our dictionary people, wouldn't be screaming, that's not what I meant. I didn't call that moderation. So if we used to eat a few pieces of fruit during the hottest parts of the year, and then for the next 9 months we never had any, then if somebody eats a couple pieces of fruit every day during the entire year, that's no longer moderation. Your DNA wasn't set up for that. And if you want to know more about what your DNA was set up for, I suggest you pick up a copy of In Search of the Perfect Human Diet, which is the first movie I've ever seen that did it right. They actually looked at the science of what is our DNA programmed to do and why. And if you buy that from the Price Pottinger Nutrition Foundation at PP for Price Pottinger, NF for Nutrition Foundation, ppnf.org, you will get the special edition version that has an additional 60 minutes of interviews with the experts that were interviewed in the movie. So, let's see, is there anything I haven't covered? We've gone over the various different sugars. If somebody is exercising a lot, and they're drinking an electrolyte drink, and people will say, well, they're going to drink, you know, Gatorade or one of the other electrolyte drinks, because, hey, we're using up all the sugar in exercise, so we're going to bring back the sugar and the electrolytes. I'm not convinced that that's necessary. I work with professional athletes and exercise instructors and Pilates instructors and professional dancers, and after I have gotten their body to slowly, over a period of about 3 months, re-equilibrate so that it can get its energy from fats. Because if you just instantly drop your starch and sugar level down through the floor and start eating large amounts of proteins and fats, some people feel like their energy went away because their body is still doing it with the wrong foods but the one it's gotten used to. So sometimes we have to slowly switch over a period of anywhere from 30 days to 90 days. But once I've done that, those people no longer need the high-sugared electrolyte drinks. They can use things like the product Ultima, which has all the electrolytes and a little bit of stevia as a sweetening agent. And we bring back the electrolytes that they sweated out, but they get all of their sugars into their body, basically, from conversions from fats. So that varies depending on how much you're exercising. So let's bring us into the last category now, which is healthy sweeteners. This tape has gotten way longer than I thought it was going to be. But, hey, it'll be that much more complete for those who listen to it. So the healthy sweeteners would be what? The healthy sweeteners would be those sweeteners which, number one, either barely or don't at all change into blood sugar, which, of course, therefore are non-glycemic or zero-glycemic, which don't have anything else that they're doing that's damaging. So, you know, obviously, you know, fructose is a low glycemic sugar, but it's damaging in another way. And I would like them to be sweeteners that exist in nature and that people have used for a long, long time, maybe not as much as you're going to use because you have a sweet tooth, but at least the body can handle them. And which sweeteners are they? And of all the ones I've looked at, the ones I like best are Mamortica, which is actually Lohan. Lohan is spelled in many different ways. One of the spellings is L-O-H-A-N. Another one is L-U-O-H-A-N. It comes from the Mamortica plant. There are two or three different Mamorticas. Gymnema sylvestri is one of the Mamorticas, I believe. Mamortica carantia. Gymnema sylvestri is another herb that helps rebuild the pancreas. Mamortica carantia is a substance that we also use for helping the pancreas, and some of the species of Mamortica or Mamortica have the Lohan in it, which is a naturally occurring substance that tastes very sweet. It is classified as a prebiotic. Probiotics are beneficial bacteria, like Acidophilus, Bifidus, etc. Prebiotics are non-bacteria foods that our good bacteria like to eat, and therefore it helps them to produce more good bacteria. So Lohan is a prebiotic. Lohan is a little bit harder to find on the market, although you can look at it. There are some out there. Then we have stevia, which is one of my favorites. It is one of the most mispronounced substances in the entire holistic health field because most people think that it is stevia, as though it was spelled S-T-E-E, Instead, it is spelled S-T-E-V-I-A. And because it is named after the plant, and the plant has a true botanical Latin name, which is Stevia robortiana, we know that the substance is therefore stevia. But most people mispronounce it as stevia. However you pronounce it, it contains all of the agents that are in the stevia plant, and there are many. There are steviacides, there are robortiacides. I interviewed James May, the gentleman who was responsible for getting stevia into the United States. You can go onto my website at davidgetoff.com into the interesting videos or healthy videos or whatever the videos I call it on that particular button. And you can see an interview with James May where he talks about it. But stevia has a lot of things in it which are very, very sweet naturally. If you were to put a stevia leaf in your mouth, I have a stevia plant outside my office door, and you were to chew it up, it would be, my, that's sweet. And then right afterwards, you would taste another flavor because it is a green plant. So first you taste what fires your sweet receptors, and then you taste the fact that it is a green plant. It's an herb. So people will sometimes call that an aftertaste. It's not really an aftertaste. It's really that your sweet receptors fire first, and then you get to flavor to taste the flavor of the herb. So stevia is a very healthy sweetener. Zero calories, very, very sweet. If you put it into a sour food, best examples of a sour food would be yogurt, kefir, or lemon or limeade. So if you squeeze some fresh lemons, some fresh limes into some water and sweeten that with stevia, you put some stevia into some unflavored, unsweetened yogurt, because of the sour taste, it completely masks the herbal flavor and it tastes like you just put sugar in. So instead of tasting like just a different sweetener that tastes good, you can't even tell it wasn't sugar if you use it in a sour substance. If you use it in something else, you might have to slowly get used to it because everything that sweetens is a little different. It's good for you to get used to. You got used to alcohol. Some people, unfortunately, got used to cigarette smoking and other types of smoke. This is good for you. Get used to it. Could you be allergic to it? Could you react to it? There is nothing on the planet Earth that you couldn't be reactive to. Anything. I mean, I have people where their favorite food is beef. Their favorite food is lobster. Their favorite food is chicken. Somebody else's favorite food, you know, is a particular vegetable. And then I have other people where that same thing they're allergic to. And if they eat one piece of it, they break out, or they feel bad, or they get spacey, or they go to the hospital, or they can't breathe. So we can be allergic to anything. I've been in practice for 20 years. I've treated thousands of people. I've lectured to hundreds of thousands of people. I have only met three people that when they eat stevia or sweeten something with stevia, it makes something go on in their body, different things in different people, and they realize their body doesn't like it. That's okay. So don't use it. Don't use less, just don't use it. Otherwise, very healthy sweetener. There are many companies that extract the sweetening agents from the stevia plant. They all do it differently. You want to get one that uses water and not uses toxic chemicals. Two that use water and do a very good job are Stevita and Sweet Leaf, which is made by Wisdom Naturals. So Wisdom Naturals Sweet Leaf products or Stevita's products are made very, very well. I know both owners. I know Jim, who owns Wisdom Naturals. I know Oscar, who owns Stevita. Good people. They both care about quality. Try different brands. They taste a little different. You may like one better than the other. If you want to have a healthier drink instead of a lemonade, you know, or a limeade, and you want a different flavor, try one of their sweetened substances. Try a bunch of different sweet leaf. I've got cola-flavored sweet leaf products from Wisdom Naturals. And, oh my goodness, there's so many different ones, citrus flavor and chocolate flavor. You put it in some water, and now you have a healthier drink. You put it in some sparkling water like club soda or seltzer water or Gerolsteiner or Perrier. Now you've got a healthier soda. Of course, sodas still are acidic, but it's a lot healthier than the real ones. So the stevias are some of the best possible ways to sweeten. And my other healthy sweetener is Yacon. That's Y-A-C-O-N. Yacon is a root vegetable. It is in the sunflower family, just as another sunflower root vegetable called the Jerusalem artichoke, or sometimes it's nicknamed sunchoke. Jerusalem artichokes taste sweet. They don't contain any starch. They contain substances that are prebiotics. So if you were to eat a yacon root, if you could find one somewhere or grow it yourself, or if you eat Jerusalem artichokes and mash them up with some nice, healthy grass-fed butter to make it look like mashed potatoes, but there's no starch in it. Now you've got something healthy. But yacon, when it is boiled down and, again, concentrated to make it into a sweetener, looks sort of like molasses, tastes like a cross between a light-tasting molasses and a honey. I've looked at a bunch of different yacones on the market, and there are many, and there will probably be more. My favorite of all the ones out there, because I like their quality, and I know that they're not diluting it with water to make it make it cheaper, is the one, the yacon syrup that's sold by, let me just grab one right here from the company off of my shelf. Amazon Therapeutic Laboratories. I know they have a number of different websites. One of them is herbdealer.com. I'm looking at a new website they've got listed on here, www.smilanthus. Maybe that's the botanical name of your cone. I better spell that. You'll have no idea what I just said. S-M-A-L-L, so like small with a second L, A-N-T-H-U-S.com. So I guess they've got another website for that. And they are in Oregon. Amazon Therapeutics is 541-846-6222. I believe that the company Sun Food also has a yacon syrup. They are a trustworthy company, and I'm sure theirs is also a good quality. So those are a couple of places you can get it. And this is a syrup. I've tried the powders available. I haven't liked them. I'm staying away from the yacon powder that is further processed and dried into a powder. So we use yacon syrup in many recipes. My favorite cookbook for sweets was done by Ilana Amsterdam, and it's called The Gluten-Free Almond Flour Cookbook by Ilana Amsterdam. And she's got a website. You can find her online. There's one problem with her cookbook. Otherwise, I love it to death. And that is that she apparently didn't realize, as many people didn't. I like Ilana very much, and I respect her, and I like all the research she did to come up with these recipes. She didn't realize how damaging agave nectar was, and so many of her recipes use agave nectar. However, you can use her fabulous cookbook, and because agave nectar is a syrup, and yacon syrup is a syrup, if you simply substitute the exact same amount of a good quality yacon syrup for the agave nectar in each of her recipes, the recipes work perfectly. But make sure that you read the part in her book where she tells you which brands of almond flour are the ones that she has found to work properly in her recipes. Because if you don't use those, it may not work correctly. So I hope you've enjoyed learning all this. I hope I haven't made it too complicated for you or confusing. I tried not to. Sometimes I put in too much information and it makes it more confusing. Basically, my three favorite sweeteners, the ones I think are the healthiest, are stevia, yacon syrup, and lohan. And look around and see where you can find them. Enjoy, and good health to you all.